Hi, welcome to Info Dumpies. My name's Brianne. I'm autistic, I have ADHD, my pronouns are she, her, and currently, my one rep max on the bench press is 155.
Hi, I'm Violet, I have ADHD, my pronouns are she, her, and I really strongly feel that the crossbow is the most bisexually coded siege weapon.
I agree. Did you know that I had never used a crossbow before, and James's father had one and said, do you want to try shooting a target? And I got a bullseye on the first two times I've ever shot a crossbow.
Hell yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Also, for one, I know you're a good shot, but also because they're historically very easy to use.
Yeah, incredibly easy to use.
Aim and fire, I should say.
Yeah. And also, I've watched more Buffy than I think most human beings have, and I feel like some of that has to rub off.
Absolutely. And you might be interested to know, this isn't even in my notes, but it's something that I know because of my notes. The kind of crossbow that Buffy uses, at least the form of it, not necessarily how it folds up, right? But the form and size is called a hand crossbow, and that is pretty close to the first kind of crossbows that were actually ever used in history.
Excellent. Well, yeah. Today's mini dumps. Violet and I will both be dumping. I can't imagine crossbows will come up.
Yeah, I don't know why they would.
If you've not joined us before, Mini Dumps is where Violet and I pick two topics apiece. They are things that are definitely worth talking about on Info Dumpies, but maybe not, you know, lengthy enough for a full episode, because usually in these episodes we're taking turns. So today we have two topics apiece, and we're going to talk about a random assortment of things that we don't coordinate with each other ahead of time. So we end up with some very disparate topics, and then occasionally we end up with very similar topics accidentally.
Yeah, it's really fun when that happens.
Yeah. So I think I'll go first, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
Today, I would like to talk about a Puerto Rican icon. Which Puerto Rican icon?
Baboni?
It's the Chupacabra.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
The Close. Other one.
Close.
The other Puerto Rican icon, Chupacabra.
The other, yeah. Yeah, because there are only two. Come now.
Right, no.
Yeah. I was just telling someone the other day that Vanna White of Wheel of Fortune is Puerto Rican. And I learned that very recently. But anyway, we're talking about the Chupacabra, who I don't know if most people know is Puerto Rican.
I know I've learned that before, but I had forgotten that until you told me again just now. I think that must have fallen out the back of my head somehow. But I really, it feels right.
It feels right. And the thing I want to bring up in my discussion of the Chupacabra is the fact that in Latin America, the Chupacabra is pictured as a lizard-like creature. In the southern United States, mostly southwest, Florida excluded, because, you know, there are more Puerto Ricans in Florida than on the island of Puerto Rico. So they're going to think it's the lizard creature too. But in most of the southern U.S., we picture it as a dog creature, like a dog-like creature.
Interesting, because I always thought of it as more of like a lizard-like creature myself.
And see, a lot of people, when you ask them about the Chupacabra, it's a canine-looking critter.
Oh, interesting.
So it's a cryptid in the Americas, chiefly Latin American countries. It attacks, for those unfamiliar, it attacks and drinks the blood of livestock, notably goats. Chupacabra literally means goat sucker. And yeah, the descriptions vary widely. The way we perceive the Chupacabra in the Southwest U.S. is different than how they're described in Hispanic countries. He's a little sick-looking dog in the States, in most of the States. And in Latin America, and kind of the Southeast United States, it's a lizard alien thing with spines that go from the top of the head down, like, onto their tail.
Oh, wow. Almost like a, I'm picturing like a Gila monster or something like that.
Yeah, it's usually the size of like a small bear in descriptions too.
Whoa, I always thought it was smaller.
No, like a black bear is kind of how it's described in descriptions of, in Latin America at least. So it's been sighted as far north as Maine and as far south as Chile.
It went up to be in a Stephen King novel, I'm guessing.
Yeah, said, listen, Stephen. You won't believe it. So one of the most interesting things, I think, is that the Chupacabra is not a very old cryptid. First sightings and descriptions are from Puerto Rico in 1995.
Wait, really? I thought for sure it was older than that.
No. Remember, we were watching The X-Files, and there's a Chupacabra episode of The X-Files, and I said, hold on, when did this come out? And it was 1996. And I was telling you, that's because the Chupacabra was a recent thing then. Yeah.
Wow.
That episode that made me mad because that episode made me so mad because there wasn't a single Hispanic person playing a Hispanic person.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, anytime they showed a non-Hispanic person playing a Hispanic person, they would play like a little, like a da-da-da-ding.
Yeah, it was awful. Awful. Anyway, the name came from a Puerto Rican radio DJ and comedian, Silverio Perez, and he coined the name while talking about the attacks on the radio. Even before 1995, Puerto Rico had experienced vampiric cattle attacks. In 1975, there were livestock killings in the small town of Moca, and that creature was coined El Vampiro de Moca, the Vampire of Moca. They initially thought that these attacks were part of a satanic cult, but TBH, if you ask an elderly Puerto Rican who is to blame for a lot of things, they're going to tell you it's Satan. Just from my personal experience, that the devil is involved.
Yeah. That checks out.
So, yeah. So the first attacks attributed to the Chupacabra proper were in March of 1995. 8 sheep were discovered, reportedly, drained of all of their blood, and only had 3 small puncture wounds on their bodies.
I just realized I'm older than the Chupacabra.
Yeah, I'm older than the Chupacabra also.
Oh, well, he's just a baby.
Just a baby. A 31-year-old baby, but yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a big baby.
A big baby. Later that year.
Oh, and I didn't know about the 3 puncture marks. I just...
Yeah.
Sorry, my brain's catching up with what you're saying.
That's okay. You're processing. What, do you have audio processing disorder or something?
Almost, yeah.
Almost like that, yeah.
Well, yes, I did have a drink today. Thanks.
Yeah. Gleba me more, me bop. Later
me
that
too.
Year, in August, a woman named Madeline Tolentino reported seeing the Chupacabra in the town of Canovanas, where 150 animals were reported dead in the same fashion.
Wow, like in one night?
Don't know if it was one night.
Still, my God.
So by the end of 1995, reports of the Chupacabra in Puerto Rico were over 200. So
there was clearly something doing something.
Yes, clearly something doing something. So from here, the Chupacabra sightings spread through Latin American countries in the southern U.S., and there were more reports of similar animal deaths. I want to talk about some sightings. The funniest part, as 2 Texans who have since moved out of the state, but I, you know, we're still Texans.
Yeah.
Are infinitely funny to me because most of the sightings that I found, notable sightings, fucking from Texas.
Oh, of course.
So someone in Texas. So we're going to go in order and look at a trend here. And I'm going to suggest something that I think would limit the number of Chupacabra sightings they keep getting in Texas. 2004, a rancher outside of San Antonio killed a hairless canid attacking livestock. The creature was first named the Elmendorf beast, but it was later found to be a coyote with sarcoptic mange. In 2007, a woman in Cuero, Texas, named Phyllis Canyon, found the remains of a creature she'd been trying to capture photos of, it was likely responsible for killing over 30 of her chickens over the years. She had the remains preserved by a taxidermist and displayed it in her home, calling it the Chupacabra. After gaining national attention, a DNA test was done at Texas State University in San Marcos, showing that it was a coyote. Phyllis said, "You don't know what the hell you're talking about." So she sent the DNA for a second opinion at UC Davis, where they said it was a hybrid of a coyote and a Mexican wolf. This hybrid is common, and the experts blamed the hairlessness on sarcoptic mange.
Wow. I'm sorry, Phyllis. I think you had a coyote wolf hybrid.
With mange. Yeah. 2008, another sighting in Cuero. Coyote with mange. Yeah. 2009, Blanco, Texas. CNN shared local footage of an animal thought to be the chupacabra. Genetically mutated coyote. And they guessed the hairlessness was from mange.
Now, okay, now, mutant coyote is pretty fucking interesting, though. almost as interesting as a chupacabra in my eyes.
I mean, with my blood disorder, I'm technically a mutant, and it doesn't make me that much more interesting. I just can't take oral contraceptives or smoke.
Yeah. I mean, true. But imagine a bald wolf with sarcoptic mange, but has telekinetic powers.
Terrifying.
Professor Wolf Xavier. copyright.
Wolverine, trademark. Bring me the half-eaten carcass of something you found in the woods. In 2010, in Hood County, Texas, animal control officers shot a suspected chupacabra. Scientists at Texas A&M said, hey man, it's another coyote-dog hybrid with mange. July 4th, 2011, Jack Crabtree of Lake Jackson, Texas, saw a chupacabra. Can you guess what it was?
A coyote with mange?
Yes. In September 2013, a family in Rosario, Argentina, presented a body of an animal they found in Vera. This one was a mummified cat.
Okay. All right. Come on, y'all. That's a cat.
A mummified cat. That's
not even... A mummified cat? That's
it
not...
It had to be a big-ass cat, yeah.
I mean, September, yeah, like a wild cat or just like a house cat? Anyway.
September 2013, reports out of St. Louis, Missouri were attributed to dog with mange. February 23rd, 2014, Texas couple shoots one mangy coyote. April 3rd, 2014, another Texas couple shoots one raccoon with mange.
Ooh, mixing it up.
Yeah. 2019, there was supposed video of an attack in Lares, Puerto Rico. We don't know what that was.
That one was real.
So what did I take from this? Texans should be educated on what the hell mange is and looks like.
Yeah.
And maybe, I don't know, someone's probably doing this. There's got to be some way we can, you know, secretly treat those coyotes' mange. You know what I mean?
Yeah, honestly, yeah. Like, I know mange is a nasty disease, but like...
Like, putting out medicated, because it's caused by mites. It's like a skin thing. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I feel like there's something that could be done. But anyway, I think a lot of these sightings could be fixed if you just, the Texas school system said, hey, this is not a mythical cryptid. There's a mange issue here.
Yeah, so, well, I suppose that would require the Texas school system to do goddamn anything.
Hey, in seventh grade, I had to take Texas history. And if that included telling me about mange, I think it would be nice.
That would be nice, yeah.
But why in the hell is the chupacabra a hairless, mangy dog thing in the States and in Latin American countries? It's a lizard. Well, in the 2011 book Tracking the Chupacabra by Benjamin Radford, he found the most likely answer. The original person to describe the chupacabra, Madeline Tolentino, that original woman, had just seen the movie Species.
That Are you familiar? Well.
Are you familiar with the film?
I am not.
Go ahead and look up for me Sil from Species. S-I-L.
Oh. Oh. So like...
You'll like notice a... something designed by H.R. Geiger.
I was going to say, this looks like a mix between the Predator and the Alien, but like it's been sitting in Diet Coke for a year.
Yeah, spines all down the back and like to seduce and kill men.
I get it. Yeah.
The sexy alien lady from Species looks like a yassified description of the chupacabra. Tolentino had told authorities she saw the movie before her report. Radford interviewed Tolentino and learned that she believed the events of Species were actually happening in Puerto Rico.
She thought it was a documentary?
Yes. So our primary source was not well and not a reliable description. The Puerto Rican Department of Agriculture analyzed 300 of the livestock victims and found that they hadn't actually been bled dry.
That's probably a coyote with mange.
Well, when livestock attacks began in Puerto Rico in 1995, and there were Mexican reports in 1996, both countries were recovering from a drought. So when animals have been put through some environmental factor, be it famine or drought, it's much easier to go try to kill domestic livestock than it is to go, let's say, chase a rabbit or something else. Yeah. And in desperation, the attacks get particularly brutal. And for those animals, biting something on the neck and letting it bleed out is one of the easier ways to kill your prey. So the answer is... A bunch of animals were like, we haven't had a lot of water. There's been a drought. We're not doing great. There's an all-you-can-eat buffet at this guy's farm.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of gruesome, but like that makes sense, honestly.
But that makes sense, yeah. So that's one of the most likely explanations for why Puerto Rican icon the Chupacabra has two wildly different descriptions for what they look like.
That makes a lot of sense. I will admit, I don't fully follow why lizardy. I guess that's more of just the original mythos, right?
But well, it got wolfified. Okay, well, because in the States, around the same time, you have some cattle attacks. People are like, well, what I saw looked like a dog.
Oh, I see. And those got kind of conflated together.
Yeah, it was in the cultural zeitgeist was to talk about the Chupacabra. So when there was an attack, people had that in their mind. And since then, you hear of an animal attack, you hear of blood loss, people think it's a Chupacabra.
That makes sense. It's also a confirmation bias, basically.
Additionally, I saw that there was a Sci-Fi Channel original film that looks terrible and has Eric Estrada from Chips in it. It is set in Texas, but filmed in Vancouver, from what I can tell. Where I've also lived, and I love to point out when it's like, that's this. It's called Chupacabra versus the Alamo.
Excuse me?
Yeah, I want to get violently high and watch this thing.
That sounds fucking wild, and I'm 100% down for that.
Yeah, it's a Sci-Fi Channel original, so you know it's going to be terrible, and I mean that in the most loving way.
Oh yeah, I would watch that, 100%, yeah. In a heartbeat.
That's my book report on the Chupacabra.
I loved it, thank you. The first thing that I want to talk about is the crossbow, as I mentioned earlier, and then I'll leave my next topic a little bit of a secret. The basic bow and arrow, as we know them, those have been used by humans for more than 50,000 years. It's one of the earliest weapons that humans ever put together to hunt animals, and in some cases, each other. And it is also the oldest, or among the oldest, weapons still in use in modern day. The crossbow, in its simplest form, is essentially a bow affixed to a stock horizontally with a lock in the rear, so like a little hook basically to hold the pulled back string, and usually includes a trigger mechanism for firing, which generally just involves turning or twisting the lock. And the crossbow oftentimes is thought of as a more modern weapon, almost like kind of smack in between a gun and a bow, but it's actually much older than that. It's a very, very old weapon that goes all the way back to where we first see it appear, even though it's believed to be even older, in 700 BC China.
Whoa.
Yeah. Very, very old.
The crossbow being in 700 BC China makes a lot of sense, because usually if it's an invention that was made way earlier right. than we would have expected it to be made, it was probably made in China. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That is the very earliest rendition of the crossbow, and it was actually pretty advanced as far as crossbows throughout history go, because it actually used metal components. The crossbow locks on the Chinese designs were made of bronze, and could also in some cases have been made of bone or wood, but the only relics that we have found from that time period were bronze. So it could have emerged even earlier, but obviously the bone and wood examples have decomposed already.
Yeah.
A couple hundred years later than that, after 700 BC, once we get to 400 or 500 BC in ancient Greece, they had their own crossbow as well. It was a relatively common weapon in siege warfare in Greece, known as the gastrophedes, which means belly releaser or belly shooter, which I think is a really cute name, a little belly shooter.
It's pretty gruesome.
It's kind of gruesome. Well, it's not called that because it's you shoot someone in the belly with it. It's called that because it was essentially a much larger crossbow than the original Chinese design. And the way you strung it was by putting the butt of the weapon, right, the end of the stock against your belly, and you pull the string back to you using both hands. Essentially, you're using your full body weight.
Yeah, that's what I did to reload a crossbow. That's what I was shown to do. Yeah,
that's the historical way to do it, honestly. The Chinese crossbow, which originated during the Zhao dynasty, was much more advanced than this and also smaller, typically like a one-handed hand crossbow, like I mentioned with Buffy. Because of that bronze trigger mechanism, it was often a lot more reliable. The gastrophedes was kind of a... It was generally all wood, And it was much, much larger and used like oftentimes full size arrows rather than smaller bolts like we often see with crossbows.
And it's hard to pull that thing back.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Even older crossbows can take several hundred pounds of force to draw back, which when we talk about pounds of force to draw back, when you're talking about the weight of the draw on a bow, like a longbow, that's the amount of force required to pull the string back to its ready to fire state. Mm-hmm. Most handheld bow and arrows are, you know, in modern day anyway, are like 50, 60, sometimes 70 pounds on the upper end. A crossbow, even a rudimentary crossbow, because you can load it using your full body weight, your entire mm-hmm. body, you know, especially the Greek ones, by bunching it up against your belly, you can get in the several hundred pounds of draw weight, making it a very formidable weapon that is relatively easy to use.
Yeah.
Because you essentially just aim and fire. It has its own aimer built in the stock. So mm-hmm. a really formidable weapon really early on. The Chinese crossbow was actually called a nu, which it uses two characters and combines them. And the two characters are bow and a symbol for servant, which kind of hints at the the mechanical nature of it, because it's like a bow, but it loads itself, right?
Or that's cute. Yeah. I like that.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. The advantages of the crossbow as opposed to a traditional bow were pretty quickly evident, because it is a much higher draw weight, obviously, so you have a lot more force behind the bolt. It oftentimes would allow for better accuracy, because when you have so much intention in your body with a traditional bow and arrow, it takes a lot of skill to hold that steady.
Yeah, to hold that steady and then focus and aim and
When you're actually aiming a bow, you're essentially using your own arm to aim, which is not flat or
straight.
Yeah,
but with a crossbow, you can front and center.
Exactly. A bow is a highly skilled weapon. A crossbow is just...
I could pick it up and get a gun. Bullseye first try. I didn't know what I was doing, and you just point and shoot.
Interestingly enough, early crossbows, like very early crossbows, in some cases may have used spherical pellets as ammunition rather than bolts or arrows. This is supported by a couple of different math-related people from China, a mathematician named Jing Feng, who compared the shape of the moon to a crossbow bullet.
Aww.
And an Eastern Han polymath named Zhang Heng. And he basically said that the world, the universe, compared it to the shape of a crossbow bullet, as in round, fairly accurate thought of the world. Yeah. But because they used spherical pellets, in modern times, this would categorize them almost somewhere between a crossbow and a slingshot.
Yeah, I was going to say, like a turbo slingshot.
Really, yeah. A slingshot with a lock, really, is kind of what we're talking about there. But if you think about it, if it can shoot a pellet, it can also shoot a bolt. So really, you could kind of use both.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The Han Dynasty in China was where crossbows really had their heyday in history, as it was essentially the most popular weapon of China at the time. The early Han Dynasty had an arsenal of crossbowmen containing several hundred thousand crossbowmen.
That makes sense based on what period in time I'm allowed to recruit crossbowmen while playing Civilization.
Right, it does. Yeah. No, they did their research.
Yeah.
After the Han Dynasty, we get into the Tang Dynasty, which is where the crossbow kind of started to fall out of favor for a long time. The Tang Dynasty preferred more standard bows and arrows and melee weapons, as the major downside of the crossbow is it takes a long time to reload, and it's not very mobile, because oftentimes you have to use your hands or feet or your body and bend over to actually reload it, which was more relevant to the battles that were happening at that time. That was a much bigger issue. It was less siege battles and more like horseback field battles at the time, so it was just too slow of a weapon.
Yeah, I can't imagine trying to reload a crossbow on horseback.
Yeah, I mean, horseback archery in and of itself is an art.
In and of itself, but the act of having to reload that while on a horse, I can't fathom.
How would you even do it?
I can't fathom that.
Around this time in China, there was a record of a repeating crossbow operated by pumping a lever that automatically drew the string, dropped a bolt, and fired in one continuous motion, though it wasn't actually considered a military weapon and was actually intended and advertised for home defense, if you can believe that.
What?
But, yeah.
Repeating one?
Now, my suspicion is that because it was like lever operated, I don't imagine that it would have a whole lot of power behind it. That's
no.
probably the issue. That would be my guess. Because if you're just doing one continuous motion to pump a lever, to draw the string, and do all of that, how much force can you actually put behind
so
that lever?
So it's for, what is it, that person who said they needed an AR-15 for 30 to 50 feral hogs? That person's
right,
always
exactly.
been around.
Exactly. That person's
like, I need
been
this
around.
Repeating crossbow in case 30 to 50 feral hogs
exactly.
barrel through my yard.
Exactly. But I would be the cool person in China that's like, yeah, I got a repeating crossbow to defend my house. A big part of the crossbow's power, as we've already discussed, came from the difficulty of the draw. And early Chinese versions and Greek versions required the soldiers to, as I mentioned, use their legs or sometimes their back and their shoulders and everything, their entire body, like kind of like a spring, right, to unfold their body to pull the string back. While later European versions, once we get several hundred years later, use something called a windlass, which is like a small metal winch that slowly pulls the string back into place.
Oh, I've seen that in movies, and I'm like, what is that little thing they have for their crossbows? Interesting.
Yeah, it's basically just what they call
hook.
A rack and pinion.
Yeah.
Yeah. And essentially, it's a little cog with a handle that you turn, and you hook the string on it, and then you just turn the handle to wind back the string. And then
yeah.
it pops into place, and it's ready to fire, which makes it much faster and easier to reload. That, I can imagine reloading from horseback, potentially. Not that I've ever even ridden a horse since I was, like, 5, and I was on a horse for a picture at once. Some of you out there, the cool ones, might be thinking, what about a ballista, Violet? Isn't that a giant crossbow? How were those used in history? That's not a crossbow, you dinguses. A ballista, or a ballista, balliste being the plural, while they do fire large bolts, they are not truly crossbows because they utilize torsion rather than tension.
Testicular
torsion. You're not pulling back
torsion.
On a string. I mean, yeah, basically, except without the testicular.
I cast
the way
testicular
that...
torsion.
If you cast that on a ballista, it'd probably fire or be ready to fire. So the way that ballistas or ballistae work, I should say, is they use the tension of cords wrapped around two large spools that, while extremely powerful, because it's very large and heavy, it's more conducive to stationary siege weaponry rather than actually
yeah.
carrying around. After, once we get into the Tang Dynasty, crossbows kind of fell out of fashion. They were kind of used for home defense. They're easy to make, right? So it's not too difficult to use for home defense. But for military-wise, we didn't see them a whole lot. And we saw a little glimpse into the suggestion that they were probably used by the Roman Empire. There's a text called the Epitoma Re Militaris, which is essentially a treatise on military weaponry, written by a writer named Vegetius.
Vegeta?
It sounds like Vegeta, but it's Vegetius. If it's spelled very closely to Vegeta, honestly. It's just I-U-S instead of A.
Vegetius.
There's very little that is known about this writer. He only wrote 2 texts, but this one, the Epitoma Re Militaris, describes the military weapons that were being used at the time. He actually refers to soldiers known as Arcubilistari, there we go, which operate alongside the standard archers. He doesn't, however, describe these arcubilistari because they're so well known it would be a waste of time to describe them.
Yeah, I use that word every day.
After being rarely depicted for several hundred years, the crossbow resurfaced around 1100 AD. It was beginning to be used more and more by kind of lower... Not, I don't want to say lower class, but really, yeah, lower class peasants and things like that. But it was also used by people who did not, just in general, have the skill or accuracy or training or whatsoever, or strength in some cases, to fire a traditional crossbow. King Henry I was nearly killed by his own daughter, Juliana, because they were arguing and he asked her father to parlay and then attempted to shoot him with a crossbow.
You know what? I don't know the context of the situation, but I'm on her side.
Good for her.
Yeah, good for her. Good I'm for on her side. Just going to default to
that. I don't care
that.
About King Henry the First.
Yeah.
He's a king.
Yeah.
Why do I give a fuck? Anyway, good for her. Because of that cultural association with ranged weapons being associated with poor people, it also came to be associated with cowardice in a lot of ways. A quote from Bertrand du Guesclin, don't ask me to try to pronounce that again, emphasizes the negative cultural connotation of missile weapons alongside the chivalric class, noting that Alba, the first man who became an archer, did so because he was afraid and did not dare approach. It was seen as like a coward's weapon at this point.
Yeah, good luck calling me a coward with an arrow in your face.
At this point, the longbow was a lot more favored in England because it fired faster and at the time reached a greater range, but it required so much strength and training. Conversely, the crossbow required so much less strength and training. It did have a shorter range, but it could just be directly aimed at a foe and fired. And this is where we start to see the concept of volleys in crossbowmen being used to offset the reload time. And essentially the way this works is you would have rows of crossbowmen. You would have the first row fire and start reloading. And as they're starting
to reload, the second row
fires a volley. Yeah. Skipping ahead to more modern times, there's a 1996 paper published in the African Diaspora Archaeology Newsletter. Donard Ball examined how enslaved people brought the West African crossbow to North America, where it was actually adopted by indigenous American groups like the Rappahannock and Catawba tribes, and they essentially adapted their own simple versions of crossbows for hunting as well.
Very cool.
There's also an even more modern tradition in Appalachia, which documents the use of mountain crossbows for hunting. And this primarily arose because it's such an isolated and historically poverty-stricken area. Firearms and ammunition were just difficult to come by. So homemade crossbows, totally a thing.
Part of my family is West Virginia, Appalachian hillbillies. Like my great-grandma and great-grandpa built their own farmhouse and just added rooms on when they had another kid. And they would hunt with bows and arrows and stuff. It was compound bows. But there was just one day where my great-grandpa's like, you need a little something. And he carved me a slingshot out of part of a tree and like showed me how to aim. And like, yeah, poor, but a great time.
Yeah.
Oh, great
absolutely.
Time, but
and,
yeah.
And you can do damage with a slingshot. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, they would eat, they would use that to get like rabbit and turtle and all kinds of whatever stuff they could find because food was hard to come by. So yeah.
So, yeah, that's my thing on crossbows.
I love it. Thank you. Well, my final topic, I initially set out to find out who invented the bench press, but then I accidentally answered another question I had and then discovered one of the most wild historical figures I'm surprised I'd never heard of before. So it's a little bit meandering, but it's about the history of weightlifting. For those of you who are new listeners or just might not have listened to those other episodes, one of my hobbies is lifting. I love it so much. I want to be big and strong. I need to be big and strong. I will not be strong enough until I can carry my entire family on my back, and that will never happen, so I must keep working out forever. This is my, this is where I am, right?
And I am a big fan of this because I love a sturdy woman.
Yeah.
And Brianna's a sturdy woman.
Yeah. Lifting weights is fun because then you have a tall lesbian come and feel your shoulders and go, ooh. Which is definitely a bonus. I'm going to answer a couple.
For both of us.
I'm going to answer a couple things. So one of the questions I had, while in general, is why are so many weightlifting exercises named after Eastern European countries? I ended up learning my answer to this while trying to find the inventor of the bench press.
You mean it's not Ronald H. Bench?
It's not, no. But my question is, why are so many weightlifting exercises named after Eastern European countries? Because there's a saying in weightlifting that if it's named after an Eastern European country, it's going to suck, but it's going to be really effective.
Yeah,
You have
you
Romanian,
mentioned that this was your topic earlier.
You have Romanian deadlifts. You have Bulgarian split squats. You have Russian twists. You have Ukrainian deadlifts. And while it's not a country, there's also something called a Soviet snatch, I'm pretty sure, which sounds like a different, like an old porno.
Sounds like a very different thing.
Yeah, it sounds like an old porno. But why do they all have these Eastern European names?
When you mentioned that this was the name of your topic to me earlier, and I've literally just this whole time been tossing around in my head, why would that be? Why could that possibly be?
So this was really difficult to find an answer to. I actually found the most credible source in the Ask a Historian subreddit.
Huh.
There was not a lot of stuff about it. There was not a lot of stuff except blog posts written by AI for different weightlifting sites and something from the website Testosterone Nation, which I refuse to visit.
Testosterone Nation?
They should give that domain name to a trans mask organization, okay?
Yeah, they really should.
Yes. Anyway.
They really, really should.
So
if I went to that website, I would just explode.
You would. You would. Well, it would be blocked for you.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, I can't go to that website because I take spironolactone.
Yeah, we blocked for you. Okay. So the answer is the Soviet Union. There was the 60s through the 80s in the Olympics. There was the Eastern Bloc the Eastern Bloc Olympic weightlifting sweep of the events. So the Soviet Union's Eastern Bloc got very into weightlifting. There was an initiative by these nations to win more medals in international competitions, to help with national prestige, to help with the nation's image. This was happening during the Cold War, too, so any visible dominance over the United States seen as a win for the Soviet Union.
As soon as you said, oh, this was during the Cold War, it's all fallen together.
Yeah. So all of this was happening during the Cold War, and the national curriculum in these countries included strength training. And the students who showed promise in their curriculum and strength training were offered spots at athletic-based schools. And then the best students from those athletic-based schools were then paid by the state to train full-time at one of the Olympic compounds.
That's a pretty sweet gig.
A pretty sweet gig, yeah. They weren't really testing for gear at this point in the Olympics, so they were pumping them full of so, so much HGH, among other things. There is a method in Olympic weightlifting called the Bulgarian method that I had heard about, and I had understood it was really hard, and you're pretty prone to injury. It involved working out 6 times a day.
I thought you were going to say a week.
No,
a day.
No. I work out 6 times a week. This was 6 times a day. Maximum intensity, maximum volume. I was reading through.
Wow.
I'm not going to do the episode about that. I was reading through it and I was like, oh, there is actually no way you could do this without being filled to the gills with God knows what gear wise.
Yeah. It's like, what? When do you do anything else?
Yeah, they don't. They didn't. After the fall of the Soviet Union, many of those coaches and athletes were invited to the U.S. So when they were naming their movements that they did, naming those movements after countries from the Eastern Bloc was good marketing.
I see.
They just decimated the weightlifting categories in the Olympics. Like the last 20 years plus, they had just absolutely been kicking ass and taking names. Yeah, in 1988, countries located in the Eastern Bloc of the Soviet Union took 2/3 of all lifting medals in the 1988
Jeez,
Olympics.
That's wild.
2/3. So you have Bulgarian split squats because at one time saying, oh, Bulgarian? Oh, shit, that's legit. That's a legit movement.
I see.
So
this is like when they say, oh, this is Dubai chocolate.
Yeah. To connote, ooh, luxury. I went down this rabbit hole when I was looking for the inventor of the bench press, who was an Estonian man. And I saw that and I was like, okay, well, an Eastern European invented it, but why? So that's why I went and I needed an answer to that. George Hackenschmidt.
That's a good name.
Good name. Cool sounding dude. He is credited with inventing the bench press, and I immediately knew when I saw his last name.
Hack squat?
The hack squat. Yes.
I knew it.
Which, I love the hack squat. If I had space to get, even though it only does one thing, and a machine that only does one thing doesn't make a lot of sense in a home gym, if I had the money and space for a hack squat machine, ugh, I'll love one of those. He invented the bench press and the hack squat. He was an Estonian strongman, professional wrestler, and writer. He spoke 7 languages, and he is credited as being professional wrestling's first ever heavyweight champion.
Whoa. So, wow. Yeah, I mean, if you're like inventing stuff like the hack squat and the bench press, you're going to be buff.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have it in your notes or anything, but like, how did he know these movements were the best movements to do?
We're going to get into that. Because he wrote a lot of books about sports and sports, like physiology stuff and psychology and philosophy. As a student, he was immediately enamored with sports. Before he even reached adulthood, he could lift a small horse and he could raise 276 pounds over his head with one arm.
I want to lift a small horse.
Right. Mine would have to be like Lil Sebastian type Lil. Be one of the tiniest horses on from a few episodes ago. He could pick He could pick up a 335-pound barbell off of the floor, bring it to his chest, and then press it overhead.
Good God.
That's... Yeah. So I'm going to be doing overhead presses today. I am not a weak woman. I'm pretty strong in most of my lifts. I'll be doing 70 pounds. A woman I greatly admire, who is a world record holder for bench press, her overhead press is 90 pounds.
That's unfathomable to me. Like, that's such a huge amount of weight. That's like lifting a very large person.
Yeah, look at this dude, though. If you look him up, George Hackenschmidt, if you look him up, you're like, oh, yeah, he could do that, couldn't he?
George Hackenschmidt. Holy moly, yeah? No, he does look like that.
So he was also a cyclist, and his normal job was as a blacksmith's apprentice.
Okay. Yeah, that'll do it. Good God. Imagine being built like Doom Guy in that time period.
Right. So blacksmith's apprentice spoke 7 languages. He wrote several books, one called Man and Cosmic Antagonism to Mind and Spirit, while he was a POW in Germany.
Wow.
He was friends with Harry Houdini and the playwright George Bernard Shaw.
Oh, wow.
He ate a lot of meat in his early life, but he became a strict vegetarian after he left professional wrestling.
Good for you.
And even back then, in like late 1800s, early 1900s, he avoided processed foods.
Oh, nice.
He said he avoided...
Smart guy.
He said he avoided everything which has been artificialized in any way.
Huh.
So he died...
He seems like a very smart guy.
He said, what? So fucking interesting, right?
Yeah, strong in brain, strong in body.
Yeah, he died in 1968 at the age of 90 years old in England. World War I and World War II, he ended up, you know, living in France, then moving to London, and he... lived in a suburb of London for a very long time. And then the thing that baffles me is this also makes me a little angry. He was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2016. The WWE didn't exist.
The guy that invented the bench press? You didn't induct him until 2016?
Okay, but the thing that makes me angry is the WWE didn't exist in his fucking lifetime. And with the stuff the man stood for, I don't think he would want to be in the WWE Hall of Fame.
Now that I think about it,
the more and more I learned about him, I was like, he would not like you, WWE.
Yeah, no, at first I was like, how could he not have been in the Hall of Fame until that point? And then I was like, wait a minute, why the fuck didn't he wrestle for you?
He didn't wrestle for you, Vince McMahon. And then
my brain just went wrestling WWE. Yeah, he should have been in the Hall of Fame. Wait a minute,
that didn't exist. China isn't in the Hall of Fame. China's not in the Hall of Fame, but this guy is.
Mm.
If you're not listening,
and we mean
China. Yeah, China should be in the Hall of Fame. Ninth wonder of the world, just great. I should do a mini dump about her sometime. First lady in the WWE to wrestle against men. But yeah, I know he's not listening, but on the off chance someone knows Triple H, tell him to go huff my entire sweaty asshole. So that's how I feel about it. Little fucking little bitch boy. But anyway, that's about Eastern European Olympic weightlifting. And George Hackenschmidt, who I need to go read more about, because like, oh, I love the bench press. I also love professional wrestling. I also love languages. Yeah. And I'm also a vegan. Why have I not heard of you, big strong man?
Yeah, honestly, yeah. Maybe he needs his own separate info dump. He's just about his life, a little biographical.
Maybe. I need to go read more about him. But anyway, that's like my cool last one. Topic.
So my next topic, my last topic, I should say, came to me when I was driving around in the evening a while back. And I had thought back to when I was a youngster. And I used to sneak out at night and ride my bike.
Warthog. Exactly. This is what you made me think of.
When I was a young warthog. Back when I was a young warthog, I would sneak out the back door of my house and then go around the side gate and ride my bicycle around the neighborhood at night. And all of the memories that I have of doing this, the entire neighborhood, and for a lot of you, this is probably, you have a similar memory, the whole neighborhood is bathed in the light of streetlights, which were
orange.
A very warm orange glow, but not anymore. And I was driving home the other day, I forget where the context was, but I was driving at night and I saw streetlights and they're all just bright white LEDs now. And it just got me thinking, hey, what changed? And that sent me down a whole rabbit hole. My last topic is high pressure sodium lights and why I think they should come back. I think
personally,
we should use high-pressure sodium lights.
Personally, as someone who deals with night blindness and sees the halos of a thousand angels when I see lights at night, the old kind of street lights were not nearly as bad as the modern LED ones for my ability to see.
Yes. And there's a reason for that, which I'm going to get into. Back before even we had those famously yellow-orange high-pressure sodium lights, cities used basic incandescent light bulbs starting in 1879. After that, high-pressure mercury vapor lamps in the 1930s. And then just before we got into the high-pressure sodium lamps, we had, of course, the low-pressure sodium lamps, which were first shown off in 1932 by the General Electric Company. The low-pressure sodium lamps are basically the same color in light terms as high pressure sodium lamps, but they were not very bright and weren't very useful for like street lighting and things like that. They were good lights and they lasted a long time, but they didn't really last all that long, I should say, compared to a typical incandescent bulb, but they lasted longer than like a mercury vapor lamp would. We couldn't really put enough pressure inside the bulb to make them last a long time because you need essentially a container that can hold a lot of densely packed gas and a little metal arcing thing. Because the way a light bulb works essentially is you have a little gap where light can arc, lightning, literal electricity, arcs over this little gap or through a wire in some cases. And the inside of the light bulb is filled with a gas that colors the light and allows it to be brighter than it normally would under atmospheric conditions, but also protects the filament or the gap, depending on the type of light bulb, from burning and destroying itself. So when a light bulb burns out, it literally is the filament of the bulb breaking because it has burnt all the way through.
That explains the noise the old ones would make when they went out.
Yep, exactly. It'll just go pfft. In 1962, there was a big breakthrough in light bulb technology. Rather than using glass, Robert L. Coble patented a material called Leucolox, which is a special see-through ceramic that can actually handle the very high heat and the corrosive nature of sodium vapor without melting.
Oh, I didn't know that was ceramic.
Yeah, it's a ceramic bulb. 1965, General Electric engineers William C. Loudon and Kurt Schmidt built the first 400-watt high-pressure sodium lamp in 1965, and they pumped out 100 to 140 lumens per watt, way more light for the money than any other type of light bulb at the time. So just per actual amount of power put into the bulb, it was the brightest kind of bulb that had yet been made. And at that point, in 1965, I mean, it's the brightest bulb we can make. Cities everywhere started swapping their old streetlights for high-pressure sodium lamps between 1968 and the mid-1980s, and they saved so much in electricity because they lasted a really, really long time thanks to that Lucalux stuff, and they used way less electricity than a standard incandescent bulb. The lifespan of a high-pressure sodium bulb, as opposed to the previous type of bulb that they were using, went from 6,000 hours to 24,000 hours.
Wow.
Why do those old high-pressure sodium lights give off such a cozy glow, often described as a golden amber glow? When we talk about light color, there's the Kelvin spectrum, which discusses like the warmth and coldness of lights. High-pressure sodium lights give off a 2100 Kelvin glow, whereas modern LEDs are much higher Kelvin. They're much colder. 3,000 to 4,000 Kelvins for the like bright blue seeming ones.
Ugh,
and those produce that.
Those.
Yeah. Those, I hate those.
I need warm light.
Those LEDs are not balanced in the way that they produce light at all. And so the blue diode, a blue LED is always going to be brighter than any other type of LED just because of the way LEDs work. And so that's why they're always very blue forward when they're super bright. That bright blue light, that's hard to say, that bright blue light scatters easily into the atmosphere, which has the side effect of spiking urban light pollution and what we call sky glow by, in some cases, 2 or 3 times in cities compared to the old high-pressure sodium lights, which this is based on a article in the Journal of Quantitative Spectroscopy and Radiative Transfer.
So it's actually brighter. You've helped me understand why my autism much prefers to have warm light versus blue light,
yeah,
in general, and why it's so much harder to see at night with the blue ones.
Yes, absolutely. Not only that, blue LED lights and bright LED lights are notorious for messing with our sleep.
Yeah.
The blue wavelength suppresses our body's melatonin production up to 3 times more than warm sodium lamps do, because our body is going, oh, blue light, like the sky? Yeah, it's daytime. Nature also suffers with these new LED bulbs, because LEDs, because of the wavelength of light that they produce, attract up to 4 times more insects. And seriously disorient migratory birds and urban wildlife compared to the mellow low-frequency spectrum of HPS bulbs.
Well, that's so interesting.
Yes. So, all of this to say, bring back those sodium bulbs. They're way better. The wavelength that it produces are called the sodium D lines, which I think is a funny term. They sit at very specific wavelengths of light, which is specifically 589.6 nanometers. While low-pressure sodium lamps keep that light very monochromatic, high-pressure sodium streetlights use internal pressure to bump the sodium atoms together more, literally, which stretches the wavelength just enough to create a little bit more of a broad spectrum so you can distinguish basic colors better. Not as well as LED, of course, but the whole premise behind LED above this is better color distinction, basically. It's brighter and you can see colors easier, which, you know, for police and whatever, that makes identifying vehicle colors easier.
Whatever, fuck them cops, bring back the sodium lights.
Exactly. But that 589 nanometer wavelength interacts uniquely with what we call Rayleigh scattering, which is the atmospheric law that causes blue light to scatter more easily. So high-pressure sodium lamps punch through night fog, smog, humidity, all of that, rather than reflecting off of it like most other wavelengths do, which keeps the sky glow low. Because of the way our eyes work, when we see light that is of a certain wavelength, like blue-green colors, our brains think, it's daytime, and our eyes do something called the Purkinje shift, which basically adjusts our eyes to handle bright colors and bright lights easier. Our irises shrink, so we aren't getting as much light, and it's harder to see in the dark, but it's easier to see in bright lights. This specific wavelength does not trigger that effect on us, so it avoids triggering the brain's daylight receptors, leaving our natural sleep cycles undisturbed, and it doesn't interrupt our ability to adjust to dark vision. So one thing I've noticed since we've gone to LED bulbs is that the dark spots that are not illuminated by streetlights seem pitch black. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was just me getting older. But no, it's because the LED lights are triggering my daylight receptors and my eyes can't adjust to it being dark anymore.
And that's why I'm having so much more trouble seeing at night since that shift.
LEDs use a fraction of the light that bulbs do, and they last multiple times longer. I know. But I think not every place needs to have an LED bulb.
Yeah.
I think for residential neighborhoods, let's keep the old sodium ones.
Yeah.
Can we at least have that as an option? I just miss it.
Like you couldn't do the movie poster for The Exorcist with the LED lights we have now.
Yeah. Not at all.
Like that. I was just thinking
it's so clinical now.
Yeah. No, just me thinking of those, it makes me think of the movie poster for The Exorcist. I was like, actually, that wouldn't be haunting at all. It would just be a guy standing there very clearly under light. You go, a priest.
Yeah. A big part of what got me thinking about this, too, is when we watched that weird Cops X-Files crossover episode.
Oh, yeah. We've been watching X-Files, and there's an episode where they cross over with cops, and it's ex-cops, and it's all orange.
Yeah. It's all sodium lamps. Those are all high-pressure sodium lamps.
Yeah.
And if you ever have a memory of a kid of, like, seeing a light doing this weird thing where it's dim most of the time, and then it gets bright all of a sudden, and then goes out again... That's a high pressure sodium lamp that has the filament has burned out, but it's trying to relight. That's a specific thing that high pressure sodium lamps will do.
Well, thank you, baby. Thank you. And since it's Monday, can you go spot me on the bench press after this?
Hell yeah. Absolutely, I will. My sturdy, sturdy lady.
Friends, I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters like Heather Watts, Nana Nussbaum, Jennifer Bosch, Patch, Harleen, Bethany, Laura Kramer, Lilith Rain, Janice Weston, Anarchista, Percy, Nunya B, Kate Michigus, Kate Genius, Dave Peril, Megan E, Carl Brooks, Natasha Neves, Gus Lutzi, Helen Clifford, Sewing Seraph, Rachel Rachelson, and Fintago. You know the deal. You want to help us out, you can tell other people about the show. If you know someone who might like info dumpies, someone who might benefit from info dumpies, just tell them about it. That's how we grow. We grow entirely by word of mouth. We don't take paid advertisements. We don't pay for advertisements. And we grow because you tell other people about us. So if you want to help us out, tell a friend, tell five friends, if you have that many, if you're so lucky. Tell your buddies about the show. Post about it in your Discord server, on your favorite subreddit, wherever you lurk on the internet. You can help us out because the more people we get supporting us, like the lovely Patreon supporters we mentioned before, the more we get to put time and effort and, you know, new software and equipment into the shows we make. So you help us out a bunch. If you'd like to help us out even further, you can subscribe, rate, review, leave a nice comment, interact with the show in whatever ways are available to you on your podcatcher of choice. This helps us get more action in the algorithms and helps people find us, somewhat organically on the apps they use to listen to podcasts. So by being active and helping us have more active interaction on our show's page on your respective podcatchers, you also help new people find us. And if you're in a place to help us out financially, you'll find a link to the Mixnomer Patreon page in the show details. Tiers start at just $1. You get bonuses for everything we've done, everything we're currently doing, everything we're going to be doing. It's your one-stop shop for that, which includes, you know, music from the audio dramas and notes on Violet and my Info Dumpies episodes with our sources, so you can go take a deeper dive if you want. Violet very often includes pictures in her notes, which I think is great. You can go look at pictures of some of the stuff we talk about. But that's the best way to support us. If you can throw in $1 at us every month, or more, if you're so lucky, that helps us out a ton. And if you want to hang out with us, you can check out the link to the Discord server in the show details. I love the Discord server. Just some of the sweetest, sweetie sweethearts in the world. You can go in there and just lurk if you want, because, you know, I'm autistic. I get it. Sometimes you just want to be hanging out where other people are hanging out, not necessarily engaging. And every level of interaction is welcome. So if you want to hang out with some like-minded nerds, go check out that link to our Discord server. But that's all I've got for you this time, my friends. Until next time, clever sign off.